Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Memorial Day weekend with a discussion on the national priorities of guns versus butter and the question whether the American Republic will survive the American Empire. Joining us first is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who served as Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. We will discuss America's shrinking middle class as more plutocratic-friendly policies and priorities are enacted by the Republican Congress, while a distracted Trump, who was elected as a populist, is increasingly mired in investigations over Russian influence and possible collusion in our election. With an increase in defense spending being offset by slashing safety net programs for working and middle-class Americans, we will assess how much as a nation we are prioritizing projecting power abroad over protecting the health and welfare of our own people at home as we improve the quality of death at the expense of our quality of life. Then we will continue the conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tom Ricks, an advisor on national security at the New American Foundation, where he participates in the Future of War Project, a contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, where he has the prize-winning blog The Best Defense. He joins us to discuss his latest book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. With the current trend of ideology trumping facts as we appear to be going back to the 1930s, we will explore how the conservative Churchill fought totalitarianism from the right, while the socialist George Orwell fought totalitarianism from the left, and given the unusually high number of senior military officers at the top level in the Trump administration, how the generals around Trump should be protecting the country, not the president. And joining us now on this Memorial Day weekend is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here.
And as an economist, Rob, what do you make of this extraordinary error in the recently introduced budget by President Trump via his Nick Mulvaney, his budget director, with the double accounting, I guess, double accounting $2 trillion? We should all have a couple of trillion dollars floating around, right?
Well, I think the American people could use it. It's not clear to me the people they intend to give it to are in such dire straits.
Well, isn't it pretty clear that everything that they are doing is about tax cuts for the rich? It's dressed up in various forms, whether it's getting rid of Obamacare, when in fact what really happened in the so-called replacement of Obamacare is a tax cut, which was really at the heart of what they've done, and everything that they're doing, both with education and with all the programs that they're cutting, seems to all be about finding ways to pay for tax cuts for the rich. Is it, unfortunately, that cynical?
Well, it's a very interesting situation because candidate Trump probably picked up a lot of votes because of his bold and direct diagnosis of what he called a system being rigged in favor of insiders, elites, plutocrats, or whatever you want to call it. And yet, since he's come into power, it seems that almost everything that he has chosen to do exacerbates the kind of maladies that he described as a campaigner. And this budget is probably the what you might call pinnacle exercise. And it suggests to me that the president is feeling what I will call very weak, because he's not governing as a moderate. He's not governing. I mean, if you go to the Huffington Post, dig up the old columns where Russell Simmons talks about knowing Donald Trump and going visiting him and thinking he was a decent man and then becoming disenchanted as he heard Trump talking during the campaign. But Trump is now what you might call turbocharging a far-right agenda, which the House of Representatives and the Senate and so forth are extremely enthusiastic about, as they're honoring their donors much more than the body politic. And Trump is not resisting them. And it suggests to me, given the expressions he's made over many, many months, that he's in a very dependent or a very fragile situation. And perhaps these investigations vis-a-vis Russia and other things and his popularity rating are driving him into the hands, or, you know, into the cradle of the far right. That's where he thinks his presidency can survive.
Well, of course, the idea, the mantra of draining the swamp has become a cruel lie. The government ethics head is now in loggerheads with the White House over the extraordinary number of lobbyists and corporate lawyers that they brought in, about whom they've offered no transparency. So it does look like capture. So then it leads you to the question in the broadest sense is, are the Russian investigations serving as a screen for the reactionaries in the House and Senate, the Ayn Randians like Paul Ryan, and the thoroughly corrupt people like Mitch McConnell, to enact the billionaire agendas, to give everything away to their patrons, the Koch brothers and others?
Well, my sense in the period between the election and the inauguration is that this question of the balance of power between the legislative branch, Paul Ryan's House and Mitch McConnell's Senate on the one hand, and the White House on the other, was in play. And a lot of people who saw Trump rally people sufficient for an Electoral College victory, and therefore Republican control of all the different branches, these people were a little bit afraid of offending Trump. I think Paul Ryan, would be rightfully anxious if Trump, as a powerful and eloquent populist, went to Wisconsin and started to take him on. But as the Russian investigations have emerged, we've moved to a place where, which you might say, Capitol Hill, the House and Senate, are more emboldened, and the White House seems to be more, tentative, walking on eggshells. And I think that this budget is a bit of a capitulation to that, just like the State of the Union address was at one point. I don't think the American people, I don't think the midterm elections or anything are going to stand up and applaud the Republican Party if this type of structure goes through. And my sense is this budget, not focusing on the mathematical errors for the moment, but focusing on the distributional consequences, the steep cuts in support for struggling people, the disinvestment of non-defense discretionary programs, I think people are going to react very negatively to this. And the only question is, in a world of what you might call plutocratic fundraising, is whether the Democratic Party can come out with a healthy alternative that inspires more voter turnout and obviously shifting from the Republican to the Democratic side. And the Democratic Party itself looks quite conflicted. And I think that conflictedness reflects the structural flaws in the American system of representation, which emphasizes money way too much and votes as a currency much too little.
But on the surface, this redistribution of money in terms of the budget is about giving an extra $54 billion to the Pentagon at the expense of the State Department, the EPA, and just about every other government agency. And it's worth noting, of course, that the $54 billion extra for the Pentagon is the equivalent of what Russia spends per year on defense. And one has to assume that they are the number one enemy at this point. And it does seem that, is it possible, do you think? I noticed that we'll be talking to Tom Ricks later in the program, who covers the Pentagon, and he's written a book about Churchill and Orwell. But in general, my understanding is that over 100 senior military officers are complaining about how the Trump administration is eviscerating America's soft power. It was, after all, it was MTV as much as nuclear weapons that brought down the Berlin Wall. And so is it possible that we could have some kind of revolt from the military? Even military officers understand that you don't need to throw more money at this already bloated Pentagon at the expense particularly of diplomacy and soft power?
Well, I would imagine the Pentagon or people whose careers beyond the Pentagon will involve working in the military-industrial complex would be quite divided on those questions. But I think there is, which might say, a sense that recklessness vis-a-vis Russian influence is very, very powerful and potent. And when I talk to people, I actually nearly did a graduate degree at MIT, where I was an undergraduate, in arms control and disarmament. When I talk to my friends who work in defense planning, Pentagon, and so forth, they tell me that the entire threat and force structure around which military planning to this day is based on is still having Russia as the primary adversary of the United States, much more so than China or any of the others, largely due to the presence of the large stockpile of nuclear weapons. And it is very clear, whether it's the intelligence community or the defense community or whatever, that there is very grave concern about Trump and his actions and the actions of those around him even more than himself. So I think what you might call the famous book, I can't remember, Mike, what's his name, Lofgren, The Deep State? Yeah. I think the deep state interests, these are not often people who are getting very rich. It's not like private equity or hedge fund or bankers or even the pharmaceutical companies. These are people whose job is to protect the United States and do long horizon planning to meet threat structures over time. And when they see somebody that is reckless with regard to that responsibility, they resist them.
Right, but this gets to the heart of the eternal question about the country's future is, will the empire destroy the republic? And it's about priorities. And the idea that you are diminishing the standard of living for millions and millions of your fellow citizens and ripping out the very safety net that makes this country vaguely livable and civilized, not in the way the Europeans are. We're way behind them in terms of social democracy. But at least at this point, we're not stepping over starving people in the streets in order to go into five-star restaurants. So this is the real question to me is, can we have a debate about this gold-plated military getting all this money that they don't need at the expense of everything else?
Yes. Well, the old saying is, if you want to be an empire, if you want to rule the waves, you got to wave the rules. And in essence, an authoritarian or non-representative democratic structure is the cost to society of concentrating our resources around managing a global empire. And I think that, Tom Ricks, who you'll speak to later, and is an old friend of mine, he used to cover Senate Banking Committee when I was working there. I mean, he knows a lot more about that dimension than I do. But on the face of it, our schools, our infrastructure, our health systems are dreadful in comparison with other OECD countries. And what we have to show for it is a much more substantial military, intelligence, black budget, Pentagon, nuclear energy, meaning nuclear weapons-related development in the Department of Energy. What Chalmers Johnson used to analyze was the real scope and scale of our so-called national security budget, including Homeland Security, was just overpoweringly large. And I think it has encroached already mightily on the quality of life of American people.
And let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Robert Johnson.
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect collect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation on this Memorial Day weekend with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. So recent polls indicate, Rob, that 89% of Trump's supporters believe he's honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his campaign promises, and 78% of Trump supporters believe that the mainstream media propagate fake news. So you do have these alternative universes that have developed over the years, and I think you can look at Fox News and others as beginning this kind of polarization where people do what they call reality shopping. And I cannot see how you can have this most powerful country on the face of the planet function when there's no consensus within the country itself about what is true and what is real. So how do you, I mean, we're having a conversation that largely progressives are listening to. I wish that somehow I could be talking to, or you and I could be talking to, Trump supporters, because I think that's what we should be doing. So how do we do that?
Well, I think the, how would I say, you're more sophisticated about how to project to an audience than I am. But I think we have to begin by acknowledging that the so-called group of experts, progressives, Democrats, and what have you, also failed a large portion of the American people over this last 30 years. And when you look at statistics on the behavior of different segments of the population in terms of economics, health, and other things, under both Clinton and Obama, meaning the two Democratic presidents we've had since the Reagan-Bush years, the outcomes are not extraordinary. And they may be the least worst in a relative sense, but in absolute, they are the basis of discouragement. So when you and I and others like us want to reach back out to them, it probably behooves us to study some literature like Hochschild's book, I think it's Stranger in a Strange Land, about
Strangers in Their Own Land by Ali Rothschild.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful, a very important book.
As progressives stop preaching as though people are foolish or the less well-educated are not, how you say, endowed with common sense, and start to listen and find out how the system is malfunctioned and why the Me Too Democrats, with all of their political fundraisers in a messed-up structural system, were unresponsive. If we can get to those places, then perhaps we can open the dialogue with that large segment of the population that has felt neglected by both parties. And I think the Democrats, in a rather sleight of hand, built a coalition around an awful lot of very important issues related to people's rights regarding their sexual orientation or issues of race and gender and so forth, and those are very important issues. But so are the economic issues that have devastated this other group of people, as well as some of the people involved in those issues we're talking about. And what the Democratic Party has refused to do is to tamper with its fundraising potential in competition with the Republicans and embrace the economic issues that the common man would care about. They essentially disintegrated, or they lost, the New Deal coalition that they had for many, many years through an incremental, creeping, kind of sneaky, but cumulatively hugely damaging neglect of economic issues. Richard Rorty's old book, Achieving Our Country, written in the 90s, is well worth reading again.
But if it's a case of the messenger versus the message, if the messenger has lost credibility in terms of progressives and progressive leaders, how do you then revive the message in a way that it resonates? Because it seems that hope loses out to cynicism. Let's face it, Fox News, Breitbart, they're purveyors of hate and cynicism and incredible disinformation. But that somehow resonates with a lot of working Americans who are disillusioned. And of course, you know, we had Barack Obama ran on the platform of hope, and many people were disappointed by him because obviously he didn't say, yes, I can. He said, yes, we can. But we have a tendency to expect the leader to be a miracle worker. So how do you reinvent the message in a way that somehow it can penetrate because it's being corrupted by the messengers?
It's being corrupted by the need to defer to money. And the messengers are trying to thread two needles. They're trying to appeal to you on some genuine basis and avoid the economic issues. So my own sense is until all of the American people really band together to drastically, and I mean drastically, reduce the role of money in elections, the size of media budgets that are needed to get elected, that we are going to continue to play this kind of wink and nod dance. What are those people looking for, that potential audience? They're looking for integrity. They're looking for authenticity. And the kind of tests that they'll make are you willing to stand up to power on behalf of the economic issues that I'm talking about? Trump alluded to those issues much more directly than the Clinton campaign did. But what ended up happening is his diagnosis and his prescribed remedies are not at all aligned. And I fear that that's going to deepen the cynicism of people. But I'm also worried about cognitive dissonance. And what I mean by that is you have a lot of people who voted for Trump that don't want to admit they got hoodwinked. Because if you go from despair to believing in someone, and then they hoodwink you, if the only alternative is to go back to despair, they're going to engage in cognitive dissonance. They're going to pretend it wasn't true. They're going to not admit that they had been hoodwinked or fooled. And the only way that comes clean is if somebody on the Democratic side, meaning because the Republicans are in power, so a challenger to Trump, and somebody who challenges the Republican House of Representatives and the repeal of health care, does something authentic that isn't designed to sneakily kind of back its way in and not offend either the plutocrats or the major corporate powers. That has to be taken on or nobody's going to believe you.
But is there a way, given the role of Fox News and Breitbart and mega churches and now, of course, Sinclair and even just as conservative and growing power in the media? On the other side, if for the want of a better description, it's worth noting that the mainstream media gave $5 billion worth of free publicity to Donald Trump and unquestionably helped in his rise. And he knows how to play them in terms of a reality TV showman. What can be done then in terms of an alternative media approach that obviously is needed if you've got the powerful right-wing Foxes and Sinclairs pushing their agenda? And in terms of the cognitive dissonance you just mentioned, they're going to still blame Hillary Clinton for everything. What can be done?
Go ahead. I think there's the challenge that you're describing is quite formidable. What I will call the Madison Avenue approach to news, meaning using psychological marketing techniques, appealing to fear and other things, is it's propaganda that is unfortunately quite effective. I think pretending and being innocent as though standing up with what you believe are the facts is going to prevail is nonsensical. I think you're going to have to fight fire with fire in this realm, and everybody's going to get their hands a little bit dirty. But I also think at the end of the day, it's not so much the messenger as it is the message and the integrity and the credibility of the message that how would I say, if people offered a better alternative, you're right, whether it's Fox, Breitbart, or whatever your candidate is, we'll denigrate it because they're playing for the other team. But if there is something appealing there, Obama pulled this off, and most people were all attacking him, and he was African-American. It's just the structure of the system made it very hard for him to deliver on hope and change. So I really think what has to happen is reform of the system that has to be brought about by broad-based activism and basically not tolerating any longer all this kind of plutocratic, wink and nod stuff. It's just, we have a broken system. Trump identified that. It brought him to office. Bernie Sanders, essentially, I believe, gave Donald Trump a heck of a lot of his playbook. Trump went around quoting Bernie Sanders. I think Elizabeth Warren's most recent podcast with David Sirota was quite heartening. There are people trying to put something forward, and they will always have mud thrown at them, and they will always be tarnished. But if they persevere, I think it's not hopeless. It's not just buried. But I also think the techniques, whether it's a denigration of the other side or promoting your own side, have been quite lackluster on the progressive side. MSNBC, if you talk to somebody who's nonpartisan, MSNBC is not as fun to watch as Fox. Fox invites their enemies on, and they fight, and they create tantalization. MSNBC is a kumbaya party for the left. It's not that interesting.
Right. Well, of course, the progressives at Fox invite on are designed to lose the argument.
No, that's not always true. I got to defend my own wife here.
Oh, that's Alexis true. That's
Gil
true.
Johnson gives on there, and she fries Sean Hannity.
That's
at
true.
Times.
That's true.
She jousts with O'Reilly.
Right.
She quite liked Megyn Kelly.
Right.
I mean, had reasonable discussion, but there are a handful. Sally Cohn does a very good job. There are a handful that really. Fox, when my wife or Sally Cohn went on and really handed it to him, you know what they did?
What?
They congratulate him and they invite him back on as soon as possible.
Wow. Well,
they consider it a battle, not the war, and they think they're still going to win the war.
Right.
But they do invite controversy, and they do risk losing in a way that progressive media does not.
Well, and just to, apropos Bernie Sanders, the book that you mentioned earlier, Ali Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, what she found out was that the people that support Donald Trump down there in Louisiana, the only person on the progressive side that they have respect for is Bernie Sanders. So it's possible for a politician
to... Fox News just put out a survey, I think it's maybe 4 weeks old now, about popularity in America. And their survey, which they had the courage to publish, by far the most admired person in the political arena in America now is Bernie Sanders. And even Planned Parenthood finished in the top three or four.
Wow.
Now, that's not the Fox audience, pure and simple. That's a broader-based survey. But they did publish those results. And Bernie Sanders, for having gone out there and said what he believed, I don't think in my own heart that he was cagily planning to be president of the United States. I thought he was embracing a mission as a 74-year-old man of trying to change the debate in America in a healthy way, and I think he did a wonderful job of that, but he almost got the nomination as a result.
And if he would have got the nomination, he might well have won. So just in closing, Rob Johnson, it all goes back, as you say, to campaign finance reform. And as long as we have Citizens United, we're never going to break that impasse. However, if the Democrats were able to pick up the House and Senate in 2018, they could at least revive the Disclose Act, which would neutralize Citizens United. But that would, of course, not be signed by Trump, would it?
No, I'm quite sure it wouldn't, and you won't get a veto override in the structure of the Congress. In addition, in this 2018 election, I believe 20 Democrats and I think it's 12 Republicans are up for re-election, so just the numbers who are exposed to losing favors the Republicans. I think in the House of Representatives, if budgets like this pass, if you repeal the Obamacare and replace it with Trump care, or just let people twist in the wind, the Republicans are running the risk of losing control. And what I find amazing is when the Republicans have kept the tourniquet on Barack Obama through the aftermath of the financial crisis, why they didn't turn when they controlled everything and create infrastructure and create a better health plan, refute some of the special interests, and essentially do a Republican New Deal. When Franklin Roosevelt stepped out and did things, the Democrats ran this country for 50 years, and the Republicans had that opportunity, and they had a man who called out the corruption, but they're not doing anything about it. They're exacerbating the problems that brought Trump to power, and I don't think that's going to redound to their benefit in the years ahead.
Well, Robert Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back continuing the conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tom Ricks, the author of the new book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now on this Memorial Day weekend is Thomas Ricks, an advisor on national security at the New America Foundation, where he participates in its Future of War project. He was previously a fellow at the Center for New American Security and is a contributing editor for Foreign Policy magazine, for which he writes the prize-winning blog The Best Defense. A member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams, he covered U.S. military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and is the author of several books, including The Generals, The Gamble, and the number one New York Times bestseller, Fiasco, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book just out is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ricks.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And taking on Churchill and Orwell, obviously they're poles apart politically, but what they had in common was that Churchill fought totalitarianism as a conservative from the right and Orwell fought totalitarianism as a socialist from the left. I take it you've had to reread a lot of stuff. I must say, Homage to Catalonia is a pretty extraordinary book, isn't it, in the sense that...
I love Homage to Catalonia. I think I've read it probably four or five times now. Right. I actually went to Spain and Barcelona and walked the streets where he fought and the hotel he stayed in.
And, of course, he was a lot of what people don't realize about what happened in the Spanish Civil War was all those left-wing idealists, including the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who went over there to fight fascism, which was rearing its ugly head. They were all sabotaged by Stalin, who didn't want them to win, right?
Yes. The NKVD, the predecessor of the KGB, the Soviet espionage agency, made its number one enemy in Spain, not the fascist, but the anti-Stalinist left. And Orwell had the misfortune to join a little splinter group of Trotskyite anarchists. And to Stalin, that was public enemy number one. He couldn't have Trotsky alive and staking a claim to lead world communism. And so Orwell, before he left Spain, was shot through the throat by a fascist or nationalist sharpshooter but then was hunted on the streets of Barcelona by the Soviet-dominated Republican government. He got out of Spain one step ahead of an indictment that would have charged him with Trotskyite deviationism and treason.
Well, it is an amazing story, and of course, I don't know how much the seeds of those experiences came out in the classic 1984, but in terms of your book, Thomas Ricks, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom, there seems to be a broader sense now in the kind of zeitgeist that we are going back to the 1930s. So we're entering or re-entering an era when ideology trumps facts.
Absolutely. And Orwell, when he goes home to England, sits down, recovering from his wound and from being chased around Barcelona, and sits down and reads all the British papers, left and right, in their coverage of the war in Spain. And to his shock and dismay, he finds that the right-wing papers are all lying about the war, which he had expected, but so are the left-wing papers. And he writes an eloquent little essay on what we would call fake news, where he says entire battles that had been fought, in which hundreds had died, had disappeared from history, and soldiers who never heard a shot fired were described as great heroes. So what you see really then is the same thing you see now. In a time of political turmoil, people start promoting opinion over facts. And Orwell came home from Spain and really made the mission of his career to observe facts accurately and to call others on it when they did not. And this is actually, I think, the other great thing about Churchill and Orwell in the 30s, when from two different, very different political perspectives, as you say, they fight totalitarianism and fascism, they also have a willingness to call out a wrongdoing on their own side, to blow the whistle when somebody who is a political ally starts covering up facts as well.
But we have a very peculiar situation here in the United States now, I think, and it came out just last week in testimony for the House Intelligence Committee, where the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, was testifying to some pretty hostile Republican congressmen, Trey Gowdy in particular, and he pointed out that when they first heard about Russian interference in the American election, on August the 4th, Brennan called Alexander Bortnikov, who's the head of Russia's Federal Security Service, the FSB, and warned him not to interfere. And Brennan said, I said, American voters would be outraged by any Russian attempt to interfere in the election. Well, as it happens, a lot of Americans are outraged, mostly Democrats, but the Republicans aren't. And you have this peculiar political environment now where you have previously Cold War hawks, red baiters like Dana Rohrabacher, making excuses for Putin, Trey Gowdy covering up for Putin, and then you got liberals who normally despised, if not suspicious of, the CIA, hoping that somehow the CIA is going to come up with the smoking gun to impeach Trump. So
it is a topsy-turvy time. I was actually thinking about this today. I was walking up Fifth Avenue in New York, and I thought to myself, where is the House on American Activities Committee when you really need them?
But would they know what un-American activities are?
Well, see, that's an interesting definition, because I think that the Trump campaign and many of the people around Trump are acting in a profoundly un-American way. Trump seems entirely ignorant of the Constitution, and when he finds out about pieces of it that say, no, the president can't do whatever he wants, he's not king, he gets very upset and says we need to change the system. So I've actually been kind of pleased in recent weeks to see the American system kind of cough and come awake and start working. Congress isn't working yet, but the judiciary has responded with alacrity to Trump's attempts to disregard the Constitution and Trump's, I think, frankly, un-American activities.
So since this is the Memorial Day weekend, Thomas, and although most people are thinking more about what they're barbecuing than the sacrifices that soldiers and sailors and airmen have made in the name of protecting and defending the United States and its Constitution, which of course is what people in the military and in government pledge to uphold, where do you think of this top-heavy number of generals that we have in the military? Because the sense is that we're sort of breathing a sigh of relief that there are at least a few adults in the room, but it is very top-heavy in terms of military men over diplomats.
It is top-heavy, and it is worrisome. But as you say, they are the only adults in the room. For example, I've been very disappointed with watching H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, in recent weeks, because I think he's gone out and become the spokesman for the president and protecting the president, which is not his job. His job is to protect the country. Yet, I also think that McMaster is staying in the job because he worries that if he left, that President Trump would appoint some yahoo like Bannon to the job. And so McMaster thinks of himself as the only thing standing between himself and between the president and the crazy national security policy. But having a lot of generals run the U.S. government, no, it's not a good thing. I think Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, has done a good job. I think McMaster and the Homeland Security Secretary, former Marine General John Kelly, have done not so well, and I think that General Flynn, the fourth general, was a disaster from day one.
Well, you bear some responsibility, right?
I do, and I've written about this. I quoted the Eminem song in which he says, "I created a monster." I actually helped bring General Flynn to fame many years ago when he was in Afghanistan. I came across an essay written by one of the subordinates, a very good essay on how to improve U.S. military intelligence operations in Afghanistan. And General Flynn put his name on the paper to give it more weight and to get it more attention. And I helped get it published. And I think that helped make General Flynn famous. And he rose to his level of incompetence and even beyond it.
Well, it's still very difficult to understand how he could have acted the way that he did with apparently his background in intelligence, somehow not know that the NSA would be tapping Kislyak's phone, the Russian ambassador, who turns out to be there.
Well, most military intelligence people are now not out conducting espionage. Mm-hmm. Military intelligence is kind of a misnomer. It's simply having information on the enemy. You know, how many tanks does he have? How does this tank work? How far can his airplane go on a tank of gas? What are their theories of how to operate infantry in the field? It's pretty pedestrian stuff, and it doesn't prepare you for dealing with some of the world's cleverest spies who are operating under the auspices of a former KGB spy himself, Vladimir Putin.
Well, but the way that, Putin does play a weak hand very strongly, and arguably we play a very strong hand weakly, and most of the damage done to U.S. intelligence has been a self-inflicted wound. I just talked the other day to a former CIA station chief in Asia who was talking about the Chinese rolling up the CIA networks. That all was traced back to the Office of Personnel Management breach by the hacking by the Chinese. The reason they were able to hack into it was that the government contractor that the OPM hired to protect its data was a complete fraud and eventually went out of business. But but this is across the board. The response to 9/11 was to throw money at the Pentagon and at the intelligence communities, and that now they've created this kind of double-dipping monster of contractors. Snowden was a contractor. Whoever released all of that NSA hacking tools to those shadow brokers, they haven't been able to find out who it is, but the assumption is that was also a contractor. And the same with the CIA hacking tools that WikiLeaks released. They apparently came via a contractor. So it's amazing to think that, you know, you can hang up a shingle, con the government into giving you a contract and hire a bunch of minimum wage workers and call yourself a security company.
I entirely agree with that.
So what are we going to do? When is the wake-up call going to be? Or is it just, are we just going to keep throwing more money at them? I mean, we are throwing, after all, another $54 billion at defense, which is the equivalent to what the Russians spend per year on their military.
Well, there is an upside to incompetence. I was thinking about this today. The saving grace of Donald Trump is that he is an incompetent man. He's very clumsy. I don't think he can really read very well. Like a lot of people who are semi-literate, he absorbs information very well when he hears it in conversation or sees it on television. And the result is that we have an almost decapitated government. There is no effective president right now. It's like we conducted a nuclear strike on ourselves. But what you see is that the U.S. government is actually pretty robust, that the Defense Department chugs along, the State Department does things even though its budget is being cut. The U.S. government, you know, goes along, moving along, kind of like a chicken with its head cut off. And I'd rather see that than have a competent version of Donald Trump. It's as if sometimes I feel like Trump talks like he's in the Godfather movie, but it turns out he's not Michael Corleone. He's the weak brother Fredo.
Well, but meanwhile, though, the mafia elders, if you, for the want of a better description, in the House and Senate are getting their way. I mean, you know, it's almost as if all of this Russian stuff is distracting Trump and consuming him. And meanwhile, they are getting all of their stuff enacted. And so,
I don't think they are. Look at Trump got slam dunked on Trump Care. They've done very little in the Congress since Trump took over. He doesn't know how to work with the Congress. He doesn't realize that at this point, the Congress is more powerful than the presidency, and that the 2018 midterm elections are just around the corner in terms of congressional thinking. And they don't like going to the polls with the situation like it is now with this president who is really becoming a burden on the Republican Party.
But meanwhile, the Senate is working on this House repeal and replacement of Obamacare, and they will come up with something. I'm just wondering whether the big issues that are before us now, particularly in this last week, the budget, and then, you know, the budget, and then, of course, the defense budget as well, which does definitely, if you talk about priorities, it prioritizes death and power over life and health, and that seems to be the way we're going. I mean, I think 100-plus generals and admirals wrote a letter recently in support of not cutting the diplomacy and soft power budget from the State Department, because they understand. I think one of them said, you know, that if you take away diplomacy, it means more work for us, you know, more bullets.
And you know who actually it was who said that originally?
Who?
He was Defense Secretary Mattis when he was a Marine general.
Oh, really?
He was testifying in front of Congress.
Wow.
And somebody asked him about budgets, and he said, if you're going to cut the State Department's budget, then you're going to need to buy me more ammunition.
So let's go through this then. You don't think that they're going to get this defense budget, which, you know, hollows out America in order? I mean, it goes back to the old question about, will the republic survive the empire?
I think that the defense budget increase, while it seems large, is much smaller than the Pentagon had wanted, and indeed smaller than it had expected from a Trump presidency. The generals see this as really the minimum that the White House could give them. They see this as a victory of the Office of Management and Budget over the wishes of the Defense Department. But, you know, the Trump presidency doesn't make a lot of sense. Things don't add up. He's not going to bring back the coal industry. You can't cut discretionary spending and increase defense spending, cut taxes, and think you're going to come out with a balanced budget.
But that's what they're going to try and do. And my question would be, can they succeed? Can you succeed in eviscerating the State Department budget? Can you succeed in eviscerating the EPA and many other government departments? Can you succeed in ripping out our insufficient and tattered safety net in order to give tax cuts to the already rich?
Maybe I've been reading too much Trotsky, but my feeling is, bring it on. Let's have a full reactionary Trump administration. Let them enact the most reactionary program in modern American history, and let's see how the Republican Party does in 2018. I think they're going to get creamed if that's what they do.
Well, but they are in an alternative reality, and I think to some extent the most egregious export from Australia, Rupert Murdoch, who has done enormous damage to this country and to journalism around the world,
I entirely agree.
He has created an alternative universe out there, where recent polls indicated that 89% of Republicans, voters who voted for Trump, think that he's honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his promises, and 78% believe that the mainstream media prints fake news. So you have this impervious kind of bubble. That do you think that this kind of punishment that you're talking about will finally, because people who've been conned will tend to get even more angry and despaired. I mean, they felt that the establishment had taken them for a ride, and that's why they took a chance on this guy out of despair. So if you tell them that you've been conned, that adds to their despair. I can understand why maybe they want to cling to illusions.
Well, I also think that a lot of the people who voted for Trump have a legitimate gripe, which is that for the last 30 years or so, the American elites, by which I mean economic elites, certainly not moral or intellectual elites, the top 1% of Americans have screwed the rest of the country. The middle class has been getting screwed. The working class has been getting screwed. Their piece of the economy has been at best stagnant and really shrinking. They are seeing their jobs disappear in the working class. Middle class jobs are going to be next as artificial intelligence starts gobbling them up. They are worried. They're fearful. And on top of that, older white middle class men have lost their privileged position in this society. I think that's a good thing. It's become a more equal society in terms of ethnic and racial and religious diversity. But it hurts to have that loss of prestige on top of economic damage. So I think they do have a gripe. I think the problem here is really the Democratic Party, not the Republicans. The Republicans being more or less true to their roots. The Democrats have sold their soul to Wall Street for reasons of campaign finance. Hillary Clinton was as much in bed with Wall Street as Donald Trump was, probably even more. And it was clear going into the election that no matter whether Donald Trump won or Hillary Clinton won, Goldman Sachs would win. So I think it's time for the Democrats to sit down and have a good look at themselves and say, how did we lose the middle class and working class of this country? Why are we perceived as being equally beholden to Wall Street? And Hillary Clinton's failure to see that and articulate that is one reason that she lost so badly and unexpectedly.
And does that extend then to the subject we were talking about a minute ago, the defense budget? Because this military and Keynesianism is also as much a Republican disgrace as it is a Democrat disgrace.
What a smart Democrat should do is stand up and say, I'm for a strong defense, and that's why I want to cut spending. We need not a big, robust military ready to pounce. We need a military that is adapting to new problems in a rapidly changing world. And you don't get that by spending a lot of money. You get that frequently by stopping spending money and starting thinking. The great example here is the U.S. military of the 1920s and 30s, and also the Japanese military of the 1920s and 30s. They had very small budgets, but they did a lot of very good thinking about what they might face in the future. And that's one reason that the United States went into World War II with a good, strong fleet of aircraft carriers. But, for example, England did not, because England had spent all its money already and couldn't afford to think through how to use aircraft carriers, which is why the British aircraft carrier plays an almost irrelevant role in World War II.
So is this feeling, though, or these thoughts are anywhere within the professional military, among the McMasters, the Mattises, et cetera? Because I just, you know, obviously we're watching the most expensive weapon system in history, the F-35, consume most of the defense budget, and it has dubious utility at best.
We're not seeing it because I don't think we're seeing intellectual, moral, or political courage in the Democratic Party. It's a perfectly easy thing to think about and to say you can be for a strong defense without being for increased defense spending. Increased defense spending doesn't go to the individual soldier, sailor, and Marine typically. It goes to defense contractors. And for the last 16 years now, since 9/11, the U.S. defense industry and the U.S. intelligence industry, by which I mean data collection, surveillance, satellites, and so on, have been subjected to a fire hose of money. And if there's anybody stepping on that fire hose, they start screaming in great pain. But the thing we should do right now is cut military spending and start thinking.
But it does seem, though, that in spite of that, your sense is that the budget's not necessarily that much greater, or not even what they wanted. It's still creating this situation of it's being prioritized over, for example, cutting the state and EPA, et cetera. So that, where do you think we stand in terms of the guns and butter? Because I made the point earlier that we do appear to be prioritizing death and power over life and health.
Well, I agree with that. And I think Americans will start noticing this when you start seeing cuts in things that are really important, like drug treatment programs that help addicts and get them off the streets, that break the cycle of drug addiction, meals on wheels that feed the elderly, to the old lady down the street. A lot of this stuff has been taken for granted by Americans, and they're going to be surprised when they start seeing it hitting their own town.
Well, just in the last minute then, what's your sense of where we'll be in 2018? You mentioned earlier you think that there could be an upset.
I think we're in a time of real political turmoil. I think Trump is more a manifestation of a problem than the root cause of the problem. He may come and go. He may be gone in 3 years or even 2 years. He must be sick of this job, where all day long he realizes he's the stupidest guy in the room and doesn't know his job, you know, the basic elements of his job. But I think the hit is as much on the Democrats as the Republicans. Until the Democrats rethink their position, their role in our society, and who they think they represent, until they somehow break the handcuffs of campaign finance, and it is something I agree with Bernie Sanders on when he said that Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street, Wall Street regulates Congress. And until the Democrats start dealing with those basic facts of who they are and who they want to be, they're giving the Republicans a free ride. But we may see the pendulum swing further to the right. We may see the pendulum start swinging back. I don't think big swings of the pendulum are good in a democracy, but I think we're in for many, many years of that. I would think a few decades, probably, until we see the economy reshaped by artificial intelligence.
Well, Thomas Rix, I thank you very much for joining us on this Memorial Day weekend.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Rix, who's an advisor on national security at the New America Foundation, where he participates in its Future of War project. He was previously a fellow at the Center for a New America Security and is a contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, for which he writes the prize-winning blog, The Best Defense. A member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams, he's covered U.S. military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and is the author of several books, including The Generals, The Gamble, and the number one New York Times bestseller, Fiasco, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book just out is Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.